Welcome to WISO Weekend, WISO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. Once again, pleased to be with you this Sunday morning. Coming up on today's program, we've got Senior Voices. Bill Felker has this week's Four Wills Almanac. And later in the program, we'll give you the deets on this year's Dayton Mini Maker Fair. Up first, a quick trip around the state for news that affects all of us. A special election next month in a Republican-leaning Central Ohio congressional district is being closely watched. It's the 12th district, a seat formerly held by Pat Tiberi, and before that, by Governor John Kasich. The district has been solidly red for 40 years now, but there are signs the Democrat running to replace Tiberi in a special August election has a good shot of winning. State House correspondent Joe Ingles reports some are even saying this race captures the pulse of Ohio voters this November.
The 12th District contains parts of Richland, Morrow, Licking, and Muskingum counties. Mansfield and Zanesville are within those boundaries. But the bulk of the 12th District is in more affluent suburban areas of Columbus, Dublin, New Albany, and Delaware County. It's tough for a Democrat to win or even come close in this district. Republican Troy Balderson and Democrat Danny O'Connor beat several opponents to win their primaries in May and will face off again in November. But as this special election to fill out Tiberi's term comes closer, so does this contest. Ohio Democratic Party Chairman David Pepper says he thinks O'Connor, the Franklin County recorder and relative political newcomer, can beat Balderson, a seasoned state senator.
You know, Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell, or Paul Ryan's PAC, whatever it is now spending hundreds of thousands of more dollars, which shows you that they are scared. I mean, Donald Trump tweeting out the other day, I'm not sure if that's an endorsement that Troy Balderson wanted at this point, but Donald Trump tweeted out that tweet the other day. I think it shows you that they're scared. So we know we're the underdogs. We know it's an uphill battle because it's a tough district, but we also are seeing a lot of momentum. The polling shows that Danny has pulled within 5 points, if not closer. We're seeing far more energy on our side on the grassroots level.
Pepper says Republicans are so scared that they are engaging in smear tactics and making thinly veiled threats to voters.
You know, there are literally voters in Delaware County who are receiving mailers saying, we know if you voted or not, don't let the liberal win. Like, almost like Big Brother is watching each one of them as they vote. So when you see them take that stuff out, you know they're worried.
The Ohio Republican Party's Rob Sekar says these are not attempts to intimidate voters.
I think that only shows that Democrats are behind the times in tactics. This has been happening for years. You know, I've seen this in presidential politics, state politics here in Ohio and across the country. It's social pressure to get folks to vote. And, you know, it's talking about how important it is to make sure your voice is heard. I don't think there's any problem with doing that.
Sekar says Balderson's race is tighter than he'd like, but he cautions not to read too much into that.
Special elections, and, you know, especially in the year of the first midterm after a presidential, yes, it always goes against the party, you know, that won the presidency. But, I mean, I think there's real enthusiasm on the ground for Troy as well. We had a great kickoff rally for a walk this weekend. We have another one coming up this weekend. And, you know, Ohio Republicans are excited to get Troy Balderson elected to the 12th.
In recent weeks, political pollsters have moved the race from having an advantage for Balderson to being a wide-open contest. Kyle Condick with Larry Sabato's Crystal Ball, a leading political forecasting project, is the latest to put the race into the toss-up category.
A lot of people, including myself, saw the Republican as sort of a soft favorite in this district, given that this is a district that is significantly, I think, to the right of center, both in Ohio and nationally, but also it's a competitive enough district that the Democrat could win under the right circumstances.
Condick has also moved the congressional race between incumbent Republican Steve Chabot and Democrat Aftab Purival in Cincinnati to a toss-up. So Condick says even if Balderson wins, if the race is tight, it could be a bad sign for Republicans in the fall.
I think there are a lot of indicators showing that the Republican House majority is in serious danger coming this November. And one of those data points has just been the Democratic overperformance in Republican-leaning special elections.
Early vote totals so far show more Democrats than Republicans have cast ballots at this point. In this May's primary, more Democrats cast early ballots, but Republicans made up for it on Election Day. Nearly 52% of the ballots cast in May were Republican ballots. And there's no guarantee in this race that voters will cast ballots for their party's candidates. Joe Ingles at the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau.
More than 300 homes in the city of Cleveland have been declared unsafe to live in because of lead. Residents are being asked to move out quickly if they have young children. Lead poisoning in children aged 3 to 6 can have a drastic impact on their development and overall health, but it goes largely undiagnosed in the city schools. State Impact Ohio's Ashton Mara reports a group of educators are now trying to change that with a new partnership and free testing in the city's schools.
You ready? Okay. There you go. It's over.
Beverly Scott, a nurse with the Cleveland Metropolitan School District, gently pricks the finger of a young boy at Scranton Elementary School in Tremont, and in a small, clear vial, begins to collect the blood droplets that form. The boy is one of the 160 Cleveland students who had their blood tested for elevated levels of lead this year.
What our program says is any kid who's age 3 to 6 in one of our schools will be tested.
Debbie Lotion is the director of nursing and health services for CMSD. She's helping lead the partnership between the district and Case Western Reserve University's nursing school. Funded by a grant from the Prentice Foundation, the program started with screenings at just 4 schools this year. But by 2020, Lotion says their goal is to test every student ages 3 to 6 in the district.
Lead is one of the most underreported diseases there is. It's extremely underreported.
Extremely underreported, Alotion says, because testing is only required for children ages 1 to 2 who are covered by Medicaid. The lack of testing is intensified by the lack of centralized reporting, according to Alotion. While a database exists through the State Department of Health, she says it's underutilized and reporting is inconsistent because it's not mandatory.
We have not been getting these lead numbers from facilities. We're not getting them from doctors, we're not getting them from hospitals, and we're not getting it from parents. So we have no idea what lead levels are out there.
But thanks to the partnership, they're starting to get an idea. Of the 160 kids tested, 11% had higher levels of lead in their blood than the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's Public Action Standard, or the level at which it recommends a child seek medical treatment. That's compared to 3.3% of children under the age of 5 nationally who had high levels in 2016. The results also show inconsistencies in exposure across Cleveland neighborhoods. And Michael R. White Elementary School, for example, in Glenville, 16% of children who were tested showed heightened levels. But at Fullerton Elementary School in Slavic Village, only one student tested at an elevated rate. Lynn Lotus, who teaches nursing at Case and is heading the partnership with Alotion, says the age and condition of housing in the neighborhoods impacts those numbers.
Partially, it's the Cleveland housing is old. 90% of it was built before 1978 when lead was banned. But it's also poverty.
More than half of the city's children live in poverty, which makes it difficult to pay for mitigation of lead in homes or for health care to detect and reverse the effects of lead poisoning. Those effects are the most dangerous from ages 3 to 6, when Lotus says the brain is developing rapidly and can manifest themselves in any number of ways in children.
We know that they have more difficulty learning. We know they have more behavioral problems. Statistically, they drop out of school earlier. And they're more likely to be incarcerated.
The screening results from the Case CMSD partnership for each individual student will be accessible by their teachers, Alotion explained, so that if a student shows signs of distress, their lead test results can be considered. It's a public health problem, she says, but an education problem too.
We've got to make sure these kids learn. And to do that, we have to change the style of learning sometimes for these babies.
After the first year of screenings, Alotion and Lotus say they've learned they'll need more help from community partners to educate parents and convince them to agree to the voluntary testing. They're also leaning on groups like Cleveland Legal Aid and the Greater University Circle Initiative of the Cleveland Foundation to provide supports for families of students who test high and need help securing new housing.
We know we can't do it all, but we can collaborate with people who will pick up pieces of it. so that we can provide the services that families need.
With 68 K-8 schools in CMSD, Lotus says next year's goal to screen half of the district's students ages 3 to 6 is lofty, but she says they'll get to as many as their resources allow. For State Impact Ohio, I'm Ashton Mara.
And in other state news, an estimated 1 million Ohio homes get rid of waste with a septic tank and system, according to the Ohio Health Department, but many of those septic tanks have begun to fail. The Ohio EPA started the state-administered Water Pollution Control Loan Fund to help low-income Ohioans fix those systems, which can be costly to maintain. The organization's goal is to bring every septic system in the state up to code, which is important for more than just individual homes. From member station WOSU, Adora Namigade reports.
Before Deborah Leonard got her septic tank replaced, it was 100 years old and causing a variety of problems.
Oh, yes, it was leaking back into my pump house. So, and water standing, sewage standing, it was bad. My system, like I said, it's very old it was.
Leonard lives off a gravel country road with her two dogs and two horses in Fayette County and has been in the same house for 10 years.
My grandmother bought it in 1951. And she lived here till she passed, and then it was given to me.
It's a problem many people are facing in Ohio, according to EPA spokeswoman Dina Pierce.
As much as a third of home septic systems are failing to some degree. This allows untreated sewage to be discharged into groundwater or surface water.
The discharge spreads harmful bacteria.
One stream flows into another and so on, so it actually affects the whole state.
That's why the state EPA started a principal forgiveness loan program in 2016. The EPA gives money to counties that then give money to individuals who need help. Once money transfers from counties to individuals, it acts as a grant. Who's eligible varies by county, but the money is supposed to help people who are low income. People can get as little as 50% off, or as much as 100% of the cost of the system replacement covered. Kelly Spindler is the environmental director for the Fairfield County Health Department.
You know, it's a long process. There's a lot of steps that we have to go through.
Fairfield County helped 9 families so far last year.
And sometimes it takes, well over a year when we have weather issues and things like that that we have to deal with.
Septic systems have to be installed. It can be hard to get the funds used up because while the service is needed, Spindler says some people are scared to seek solutions for their defective septic tanks for fear of being penalized.
Because people are afraid to contact us because they may know they have a problem.
According to Spindler, a new system can be up to $20,000, but is $5,000 on average.
So we try to make it a way so that they don't feel like they're going to get in trouble if they make a phone call.
Because of the long process, several counties have not yet chosen recipients for the 2018-2019 cycle and are still looking for people to apply. Almost 80% of Ohio counties received some sort of funding. Even though it took 2 months for the Fayette County Soil and Conservation District to install Deborah Leonard's new septic system, it was a worthwhile wait after years of problems. She smiles as she shuffles to the side of her house, pointing out the features of her newly installed septic system.
Similar to an irrigation system, and there's tubes runs all through here, and then there's two tanks there, there's a computer box, and it's all computerized. It'll turn on a certain time and run the system. But it has a, alarm system on if something goes wrong. And and a couple of things just went wrong. No big deal. So, that's trial and error on things. They have to work it out. But it works fine now.
For Ohio Public Radio, I'm Adora Namigade.
I'm Jerry Kenney. This is WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. Thanks for joining us. Support for WYSO is brought to you by Dayton Metro Library's Party in the Park. The event will offer games, entertainment, activities, and experiences for all ages. It's Saturday, August 4th, 1 to 4 p.m. in Cooper Park and the main library in downtown Dayton. Information is at daytonmetrolibrary.org. Also coming up in August is the third annual Dayton Mini Maker Fair. Last year's event drew several thousand visitors. The event is a two-day celebration of people who, as you may have heard, know how to make some really cool stuff. To get the details on this year's event, we spoke with Emily and Josh Corey of Make It Dayton, the group behind the event. First, they tell us how the Maker Fair got started.
It was actually a group of about five engineers from the base that were all kind of working in different areas of the maker movement. And we started putting our heads together and thinking about how we could bring the things that we love to the community.
And tell me when the organization started and how it's grown over the last couple of years.
So it started about 3 years ago. So this will be our third Maker Faire together. Before that, we had the AFRL Maker Fest, which was a pretty cool little event that we had, sort of the precursor to this larger event that we have here at Carillon Park. So whether you're interested in, you know, hobbyist level 3D printing, or you like to knit and crochet, maybe you're into ham radio or, you know, building models, anybody is welcome to join us.
Josh, can you tell me a little bit about participants?
We've got everything from the emerging fashion incubator to remote control warships that guys build and battle. The big sort of showpiece is the Boneyard build-off, Mendelssohn's liquidation outlet. It's a Dayton institution. We raid Sandy Mendelssohn's stock. We steal stuff and we make these teams build a mystery challenge over the course of the weekend to compete on Sunday for a $1,000 prize provided by Dayton Regional Green.
I know last year you started a social media campaign. How has that increased the awareness of your organization?
Yeah, so our social media presence has really grown over the last 2 years, and we have quite a few followers. Actually, I'd like to give a shout out to Kevin at Little Fox Engraving because he's my biggest tweet buddy. We've got some interesting Twitter chains going out there, but I think we've had a lot more exposure this year and people are really starting to understand what Maker Faire is about. You know, I think if at the beginning people thought we were maybe a little bit like a craft show or something like Hamvention or Tech Fest. But really, we take the best elements of all those things and blend them together into something that's totally new and totally different.
On Twitter, is it at Make It Dayton?
So we do have at Make It Dayton. If you want more information specifically on the Maker Faire, it's at Maker Faire Day. So MakerFaireDay.
And tell me a little bit about the hashtag Where Dayton Is Made.
Yeah, so Where Dayton Is Made is one of our campaign hashtags that we've been doing. And it's really speaking to the fact that we have a lot of history of invention in this city, going all the way back to the Wright brothers and Kettering and Deeds. So Dayton is the place where things have been made for centuries. And we're looking at, you know, towards the future of this is where Dayton is made here at the Maker Faire. This is where you're going to find that next new thing.
Tell me a little bit about some of the challenges for people who want to make things, start a new business, or become part of the economy here in the area.
I actually do a little bit of that professionally as well. So I'm over at the University of Dayton, and I'm heading up our entrepreneurial program for the School of Engineering called Leonardo Enterprises. In addition to that, I think, you know, Dayton has really undergone a revolution as far as entrepreneurship. If you look at what the Dayton Entrepreneur Center is doing, if you look at Tech Town or the renovation of the arcade space, everybody's taking technology-based startups very seriously in this town. And I think Maker Faire is one part of that ecosystem. When we organize our event, it's kind of a mixed bag of who actually signs up. Right, we never know who's going to come in the door for Maker Faire and be an exhibitor. And actually, this year we've got 75 or so exhibitors, which has really been great for us. But out of those 75 or so exhibitors, we like to look at the list and try to pair people together that might not think about talking to each other. So one example of that is we put Tim O'Sullivan, who's a local veteran. He creates these really cool movie-accurate costumes that are 3D printed. So he does C-3PO. He did Iron Man, War Machine. Who knows what he's going to bring this year. But we put him next to Gorilla Maker 3D Printers, which is a small 3D printer startup out of Northern Kentucky. And we put him in there with Parts Express, all in the same area in the park. And it was really great last year because Tim O'Sullivan actually partnered with Gorilla Maker to get some 3D printers for his real charity business, which is creating 3D printed prosthetics for wounded veterans, right? So all the costumes that he does, all that is to raise money for his prosthetics charity. So Gorilla Maker 3D Printers is partnering with him now, and Parts Express is actually helping to fund his operation. So those are people he wouldn't normally talk to, and it was great that we were able to help him make that connection.
Josh, give us some more details about the Boneyard build-off.
It's a great competition. We steal Sandy Mendelssohn's inventory, and we tell these teams what to build at the end of the day. Sunday, we're holding this competition. So last year, they had to build water balloon launchers. We had five teams. And you would think a water balloon launcher, everybody's going to come up with the same thing. No, they were wildly different. We had a 20-foot tall trebuchet. We had this big thing that used a spool, took three guys to fire. The distance record on that was 300 feet. And I'm not saying we hit a car in the parking lot, but I'm not saying we didn't either. If that was your vehicle, no, we did not. But so we've got, I think all four teams are returning teams this year. No, we do have one new team from the University of Dayton, the engineering school, the Kettering Lab Clowns. They're new this year. But we've got the reigning champions coming back, the constant variables. They've won both previous build-offs, and they're looking to do the three-peat. So, and then the first year they had to build go-karts. So if you can imagine putting a go-kart together in a day, they managed to pull that off.
Is your organization or events like this one a part of a larger network?
It is. So the Mini Maker Faire here in Dayton is part of the larger organization of Maker Faires. It's a licensed event from Make Magazine, who put on the original Maker Faire out in the Bay Area, I think 10, 11 years ago. That one has gotten huge, but they're all over the country now.
Our next closest Maker Faire cousins are in Cincinnati, and then also up in the Cleveland area, they have Maker Faire as well. So we're hoping that eventually our Dayton Mini Maker Faire will have the opportunity to grow to the Dayton Maker Faire. So that goal is roughly when we get about 100 exhibits and around 10,000 attendees. So we're well on our way towards that with 75 exhibitors, and last year we had around 3,000 attendees. So come out and help us drop the mini from our Maker Faire name. We'd really appreciate it.
And tell me what kind of response you've had from vendors from past events.
Yeah, so we've had actually a lot of our exhibitors are repeats, but then I think every year we've had around 10 to 20% new exhibitors, which has been really great growth for us and great turnover. So some of your old favorites will be returning again this year. So we have Mr. C, who's always a big crowd favorite. We also have Rar Dragon. So last year, if you were able to make a little polymer clay dragon and take it home, that same booth will be here again this year, as well as we have some other cosplayers this year. So we've got Just Some Nerd. He's a big YouTuber. He's going to be coming as Jack Sparrow. So if you're a Pirates of the Caribbean fan, come on out for that. And we also have Scott Phillips from the American Woodworkers. So another big name who's coming down for the Dayton Maker Faire this year. But yeah, so a lot of fan favorites, a lot of new things this year.
The Mini Maker Faire is August 4th from 9:30 to 5 p.m. and August 5th from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. Where can folks find out more details?
You can go to the Carillon Historical Park website, daytonhistory.org, or you can go to dayton.makerfaire.com. That is our event page. And at that page, you can actually see a listing of all the exhibitors we're going to have, as well as a schedule of events.
Emily and Josh Corey with Make It Dayton, thanks so much for your time and information.
Thanks. Thank you, guys.
This week on Senior Voices, we meet 84-year-old Connie Cole. Born in Minnesota and raised in Washington, D.C., she came to the Dayton area in the early 1960s when her husband got a job at Wright-Patt. Together, they built a house and raised their three kids in a neighborhood called Seville in Riverside, where she's lived ever since. Connie shared her memories with Dayton Metro Library volunteer interviewer Jason Coatney Schuler.
Well, we built the house in an area that was brand new, so they were all young families just like us. And, you know, like I was a Boy Scout and Girl Scout leader, and for the Boy Scouts, you know, they all lived in the neighborhood. It was wonderful. You know, I'd say, give my son a note, and the teacher would announce it and save me all the calling and so forth. It was because they were all in the same school. Mm-hmm. That was nice.
Tell me a little bit about what downtown was like, if you can remember that in the 60s.
Right. That used to be my treat. While my husband watched the children, I would take the bus downtown. Yeah. And just, you know, there was a dime store down there, and we, you know, I'd have lunch there and then go to the West Elder Beerman and what is now, I guess it was, I think it was called Reich's at the time. And there was one of, there were three large stores downtown. And that was my Saturday treat to get away from the youngsters.
That's great. What is your favorite thing about living in Dayton?
Let's see, the favorite thing. There are just so many opportunities. I mean, you know, I think that looking back, I enjoyed my little trips downtown, but my daughter and I have season tickets to the opera, and we have I do water aerobics three times a week. We have a nice recreation center, and I just think they have opportunities for everything.
That was Connie Cole speaking with Jason Coney Schuler as part of the Senior Voices Project. This interview was edited by Community Voices producer and Senior Voices Project coordinator Jocelyn Robinson. Senior Voices is a collaboration between the Dayton Metro Library, Rebuilding Together Dayton, and WYSO. The series is made possible by the generous support of the Delmar Healthcare Fund of the Dayton Foundation.
This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac. We're the fifth week of deep summer, and the third week of the black-eyed Susan Moon, and the first week of the Sun in Leo. Last week, walking west down my street late in the evening, I could see Venus straight ahead of me, a deep red-orange marker in the sky in the very last of sundown. I looked up and around, trying to find the Big Dipper and the Summer Triangle, prominent stars of a July night. I could see Jupiter in the southwest to my left, but haze or high clouds kept the constellations hidden. The moon, new and dark, had set an hour or so earlier, and I was alone with the planets. Well, not that I was really alone, surrounded by houses and cars going by a few blocks away, but I felt comforted by the presence of Venus and Jupiter, and I wondered why that was. Had I needed to find my way in a wilderness night, they might have been of some help, but I knew where I was and where I was going. Maybe they were something like lighthouse beacons, I thought, marking safety and home. I was not at sea, or so I believed, but it seemed they offered a kind of comfort of context, as though they were guides or companions in a trackless space or time, as though they promised that the end of some journey or other was at an end. I really don't understand the source of my feelings then. They must have come out of my mood on that particular evening, but I can't remember what the mood was. I only remember that Venus and Jupiter were beside me and in front of me, and that they gave me a meaning and a direction that I needed and wanted. This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac. I'll be back again next week with notes for the sixth week of deep summer. In the meantime, walk in the night and look for Venus and Jupiter. They're still there.
Bill Felker contributes to newspapers nationwide, including the Yellow Springs News. Bill resides in Yellow Springs. Poor Will's Almanac is also available as a podcast at WYSO.org.
That's it for this week's edition of WYSO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO, giving voice to our community, our nation, and our world since 1958, thanks to generous listeners like you. Join us again next Sunday morning at 10. I'm Jerry Kenney. Coming up next on WYSO, It's Vic McCunis with the Book Nook.